Hello and welcome to Reclaiming My Theology, a podcast seeking to take our theology back from ideas and systems that oppress. I am your host, Brandy Miller, and I'm so grateful to be coming back now from our extended break for the holidays. It was so good to get to rest and really to renew the vision of what we're doing here at Reclaiming My Theology and to dream up ways that we want to grow and change in the future. One significant change that came out of that was that we are going to change Reclaiming My Theology to a bi-weekly podcast. No, not two times a week, two times a month. Because we want to do better. We want to do better in our engagement with guests, in our engagement with the material, in how we research, in our sound quality, in the kinds of materials and content that we're able to produce and to provide to continue to help people in this theological and religious journey. So consider this week one of a new season, in not a new season of, because we're still talking about purity culture, Reclaiming My Theology. And on today's episode, I am joined by Chrissy Davies to talk about modesty. We discuss the ways that modesty culture is used to control and dominate people rather than actually doing the things that it says that it's trying to do and keeping people quote unquote sexually pure. There are some swears in this podcast, pretty much exclusively from me. And with that, please enjoy this episode with Chrissy Davies. All right. Well, Chrissy, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I appreciate your time. And I know I'm a bad scheduler, so I'm grateful for your patience with me and your kindness and all of that, too.
Oh, not a problem at all. Scheduling. All good.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here. And you know from listening to the podcast that I want to people to get to know you as we get into this conversation on modesty, because I know that some people are going to look at this conversational topic and be like, ugh! And so I think getting to know you matters, especially in these kinds of conversations. And so, Chrissy, I would love for you to describe for folks, what does it mean to be you?
I love this question. And I think for me, gosh, in a way, in this season, I'm kind of just remembering, figuring that out again. Who am I? We just moved here from South Africa after living there for 14 years, doing various work there. And so now coming back to Seattle, I'm basically trying to figure out how to follow my own dreams and desires. And also at the same time, holding that space for my three teen tween girls and, you know, in the biggest transition of their lives, right? Like, so there's a lot right now. What it looks like to be me is holding that tension between listening and following carefully what my heart is saying, but also holding space for others and trying to have a whole lot of grace, because, you know, I am a person. and I make mistakes. I'm also married to my husband of 18 years as of this week.
Wow.
And he's I know. We're a whole legal adult in our marriage. we're figuring it out. Right? So for me, I feel like to answer that question, who am I, or like, what does it mean to be me, feels like I'm in process.
Totally.
I am fully in process and in high transition and trying to hold that really gently with grace.
I wonder if other folks who are listening need to hear that too, that high transition and need for grace and figuring out who you are in the midst of that. That's such a real thing that I've recently experienced. And so I hold a lot of space for you in that kind, especially when you're doing international with family and figuring out like what your dreams and what your dreams are and who you are. That's really significant. And I would love to hear a little bit about some of those dreams. How is it that you spend your time? What's your sense of vocation? How do you show up in the world?
Yeah. Yeah. So at my dreams actually is what brought us here, right? So that's how we got to Seattle. And for me, leaning into the gifts that God's given me of being a listener, being a person who does hold space well. That's what, you know, I know the people's stories at the grocery store just because people talk to me. And so for me right now, I'm privileged to work with Soul Reparations as a spiritual director, which is a nonprofit that offers spiritual direction for free for women of color. And that has been both a vocation, but also a saving grace for me. It's been,
of course,
such a life-giving space, and I'm grateful to be able to hold space for others. I'm also employed with Servant Partners, which I am currently on sabbatical with. So my work currently, just right now, is doing spiritual direction, which is my life, and I'm loving it. It's really, really been beautiful.
I love that. And anyone who listens to the podcast knows I am the biggest fan of Soul Reparation. Soul Reparation serves so many women of color who listen to the podcast. And part of our dream at Reclaiming My Theology has been to figure out how to support Soul Reparations as much as possible, knowing that, especially as we go through these topics, that they're not just like intellectual or political issues. They are spiritual formation and malformation issues. And so as we seek to create context to unlearn malformation or deformation in our faith, y'all's work is so important. So I just want to say thank you for being a part of that, because it's such a gift to me and to listeners of this podcast, for sure.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be here and to be able to enter into this world and space, because yeah, it's a lot. And I can definitely attest to the reality of needing to the safe place to process and to think through.
Well, and I'm sure that some of the stuff that we're going to talk about today and the topic of purity culture at large comes up in your work. And before we jump into the specifics of modesty, because I think that one of the things that, as in the spirit of what I was just saying, things like modesty or consent or all of those things have such political ramifications now that I think people who grew up in faith spaces often see them as intellectual or political pursuits rather than internal things that we need to work out. So I think many of us change our mind about things but don't address the issues that are internal for us, that came from the ways that we were raised, the thoughts that we were given, that were considered truth, and all of those things. And so as we get into more of that stuff, I just want to name that the work that you do is really important in that, because I think for people like me especially, I bypass the heart to go straight to the mind and then straight into praxis or kind of an active expression of faith. And so before we get into that, I would love to hear a little bit about your history with purity culture, knowing that you bring in your own experience of this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, man. Purity culture. So the whole thing feels like, oh, wow, this is it, you're right. It so infiltrates so many different places. And to come back to kind of what is your own experience. And I realize for me, as growing up in a home that was, you know, it was kind of church, kind of not, right? Like, we went to our Episcopal church, but like, you know, Sundays, Christmas, Easter type of thing. But so for me, that was not like a predominantly Christian space. But at home, it was not also a conversation we talked about, right? Sexuality was not openly talked about at all. And basically, the words from my mom were like, don't go around showing your natural behind or keep your legs closed. But there was also kind of this other message from my mom that was like, well, you know, you got it, so show it, like, respect your body, but like, just, you know, it's okay. You don't have to button up that, you know, so she would just want us to be our best selves, as her daughters in the world. And that was real for me. And I held on to that. But when I started going to like youth group and, you know, Young Life, like with my friends from school, I got a whole nother like bucket of stuff and where it was really more about like, okay, you need to be modest and you need to be to cover up and you need to wear that t-shirt over your one piece swimsuit and with shorts and, you know, cover like to go in the water. Like you can't show your body at all, because if you do, you could cause these friends, your young male friends, to stumble. And there was something that didn't really work for me with that, but that's just, you know, I remember because I had that voice from my mom as well. It's like, just, you got it, we're young, it's fine, be free. But then, you know, I was a kid, I was like, oh, this has something to do with my soul, right? Like, if I don't do this, then my mom's not thinking about it in that way. So I need to actually listen to these people who are telling me to cover up. And then fast forward to like, I was on staff with a college ministry, and I feel like that season of life felt more, purity culture felt infiltrated more in a way that I saw a lot of support needed for the men in our fellowships to like have small groups and like accountability partners and like prayer, like deep prayer about like not looking at porn but it was also so much, right? Like it was like wow, this is okay, is this not we are suppressing something that comes actually rather naturally. And yes, I get, you know, within reason, right? But still, it felt like a lot of energy put towards don't have sex, don't look at porn, don't do these things that, like, don't be too flirtatious, don't be running around acting a fool. Like it just for me, I think I re-looked at all of these. I didn't look at it then, but now I can look at it and say, well, I don't know what we were really, we spent a lot of energy on things that were not necessary. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, really moved from, like, you're like, if this is what we say the center is, then we're like all the way over here. Right. And assuming that if we don't talk about not talking, or that if we talk about not talking about sex enough, then we're not going to have it. And I'm like, okay, well.
Right. And these,
the amount of energy we put into it is proportionate to, okay, well, maybe what I'll say is, I have never experienced a more intense group of young men than college-age young men trying not to have sex.
Yes. Yes. So intense. And writing songs about it. Like, there was just, like, I remember literally friends writing songs, and I'm like, that's a beautiful song, right? Like, God is with you, right? Like, but it's just internal, you know, and that was the struggle. That was the focus for me. And I look at it, and I'm like, if we didn't focus so much on it, then it wouldn't be that struggle, right? Like, we wouldn't necessarily, like, because you're saying that this is bad, you are going to go to hell. The Lord looks at your soul in this way. Like, but I always had that question, like, why would God give us these desires if we weren't supposed to, like, learn about them and hold them well, right? Like, it's not, I'm not saying, you know, forget about it completely and just, you know, but I think there's something to be explored, right? Like, there's something to understand that wasn't necessarily encouraged to understand.
Yes. And I think that experience is pretty common to people who were in any kind of purity culture, particularly who had it through their high school and early college age, where youth pastor panic about sex is at its highest. And I think that this topic of modesty feels really important to me because it is, I think, one of the primary tools that builds the culture of purity culture that says who is at fault, who is inherently innocent, who is responsible, who has agency, who doesn't. And I want to name that in this current moment, conversations about modesty are kind of complicated because modesty is ill-defined. And so we're going to be talking specifically about evangelical, mostly Western Christian interpretations of modesty and not trying to make cultural conclusions or political statements about things that I don't have any business, like, really trying to add interpretation to. Because I think there's ways that it can sound like I'm, like, if we say that we're, that modesty is not bad, or if modesty is bad, that we're claiming certain things about certain cultures and how they exist, or about certain movements and things where I'm like, okay, we can be totally supportive of women in Iran who are trying to fight for freedom and notice all of the geopolitical ideas that are rooted in evangelical Western Christian ideas of modesty and purity culture and backlash, and that the rhetoric doesn't always come from a single place. So I just want to name for listeners that we can support our political ideologies around modesty and not be ethnocentric, problematic, anti other forms of religious expression people. Absolutely. And if we hold the conversation in our particular focus of this podcast, we'll do ourselves a lot of favors. I also want to name that modesty has a lot of definitions in and of itself, but the definition of modesty in purity culture is its own thing. So I would love for you to describe and help us to get on the same page about what modesty is. And we'll start to flesh out that particular and focused space rather than, well, I'll go broader because I am who I am, but rather than the broader to start. So can you tell me a little bit, what is modesty? Can you get us on the same page about that?
Yeah. So I mean, I love that you're helping us focus here because it, I looked up actually the definition, what is modesty, just to kind of brush up on my Webster dictionary. And it's like the quality of not being too proud or confident about yourself or your abilities. And I think, you know, when I sat with that and I thought about my experience of modesty in Christian spaces, like obviously I've got a little bit of experience outside of the US and it was felt very different. Thinking about those two, But in the U.S., I felt like growing up about in Christian spaces with modesty, it felt more about dressing, like how you presented mm-hmm. yourself, how you covered your body, like we said before, right? Shorts and bikinis and like short shorts and bikinis or short skirts. Those were not things that were allowed or felt welcomed, let's say. They were frowned upon. But I think more so, it felt like this, what is the word? It felt like a weight put on young women especially, to be responsible for your own personal faith and that of the unsuspecting male who might see some midriff. And that that for me is problematic, but at that, like, you know, like, I think I was in a youth group where they'd started talking like about or circulating those books. I think you've talked about them before, like the Kiss Dating Goodbye and Lady in Waiting. And I didn't read them because I, when I looked at the titles, I was like, this felt extreme. But I did have conversations about those things, and it felt very much like, especially within like a girl's Bible study where it's talking about lady in waiting, being single, but how you're supposed to prepare yourself for a mate, for a male, for a husband. And that, like, you needed to be modest and you needed to do that because it made you more pure or better before God and more acceptable as a wife. And that, I mean, as I say that, my mind kind of explodes a little bit, and it hurts a little bit to remember, like, because that was as a teenager, as a 14, 15 year old, I'm being told that my body is dangerous in some ways, right? Or even powerful, right? Like, I did get told, your body is powerful. You have to rein that in, right? You mm-hmm. have to be, like, because if you don't, then it can hurt both you and, you know, your boyfriend. And that was how it was couched. Yeah. That was what modesty looked like. Does that answer the question?
Yes, totally. And it's rough because I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier, which is that particularly women and queer folks are given messages that something about you is, like, so sexually overwhelming mm. that it's dangerous, but also, like, you're made in the image of God and you're, you know, Psalm 139, you're beautifully and wonderfully made, and, like, God knew you from the womb and was, like, real careful about creating every part of you except for this part of you that is somehow going to, yeah, I don't know. And it's interesting because what you're describing to me actually feels like, for all of the religious rights conversations about grooming, and, like, the kind of behavior that and control and mechanisms that are used by particularly men in power mm-hmm. to really for around pedophilia, but the mechanisms are really similar to how pastors teach modesty to women and to queer folks, that create mechanisms of control and dominance, and that say, like, you have this one purpose as a woman, and you need to protect it like a little treasure in your heart. And if you don't, like, one, I think it plays into rape culture, like, the if you don't do the thing, then you get whatever's coming to you, or like the assault that you experience mm-hmm. or the objectification you experience is your fault because you didn't do the thing to quote unquote keep your brother from stumbling. And we'll get into the scripture of it all in a minute because there's so much. Mm. But I think what's challenging is that also in the definition that you named, modesty is this internal disposition that actually gets, I think, conflated with humility. Yeah. And for Christians, in my experience, our interpretations of and our definitions of things like modesty and humility are less what I think the Bible talks about, which is actually more economically based and about empire. Mm-hmm. And it becomes more Platonic or Hellenistic in its thinking. So Christians like to think of ourselves as, like, acultural in our interpretations of the Bible. But when we think about modesty, there is this way that modesty is hyper fixated on the relationship to the body. Hmm. And I think when I've noticed that a lot of pastoral figures in trying to talk about modesty now that purity culture is kind of is being critiqued all over the place are like, well, it's about your heart and your posture and like whether you want to glorify God or not. And I was like, y'all weren't saying that in the same way before. No. It might be about honoring God with your body or your body as a temple, but those were the texts that we used more so than this other thing. And so I think this hyperfixation on the body and this distinction between body and spirit and this platonic dualism and this splitting has a huge part to do with how Christians think about modesty. Mm-hmm. And it exposes, I think, the ways that modesty has almost always been about controlling women's bodies mm-hmm. and controlling queer folks' bodies to the benefit of men in power. And I typically would say like white men, but I think men of color do this. Men of color leaders do this. I mean, really, really badly. And so I'm hearing in those places of, I'm hearing in how you're describing modesty that it's this external dress code more than it is actually any kind of internal posture. But then we have to put rhetoric on those postures to make them make sense.
Yeah. Well, and I'm with you there because I think in contrast, right, to what my experience was is in America, like to the in South Africa, I felt very much more like modesty felt like, well, don't be boastful about your accomplishments, right? Like it feels like there and there, you know, obviously in Africa, or at least where I was, it felt very much more like, you know, there's not the taboo around bodies, right? Like it's just be body acceptance is so much more without like pushing it. It's just the reality. It's like, this is your body. This is what it does. All right. And then, moving on. And then that, and so I think being here and understanding like, oh, this is that separate, that layer of like judgment basically is what it feels like. Judgment mm-hmm. of over what is created instead of like uplifting the, like the fearfully and wonderfully made piece, right? Like, yes, that's true. And how do we, you know, how do we also deal with what is happening in our bodies and the desires and the things that rise up in us? And it's just, it doesn't, I feel like there's so much damage that's done with holding those scriptures over people instead of helping us dive in and dig apart and dig into and feel like, okay, this is what I can work with God. this is what yes. I get the conversation I can have with God about my body.
Well, and it makes me think about how modesty is not then applied equally to bodies. And so I think about how Black girls are never considered Black girls. They're always Black women. When I think about how Black girls are treated by the police or how someone like Aaliyah in the R. Kelly situation was treated. Like, she was always a woman. And, like, Beyonce versus Britney Spears. Like, Beyonce was always a woman, and Britney Spears was this, like, virginal whatever. And I think about how, for fat folks, there's this dual message of you're completely undesirable, but also anything you wear, because things might be form-fitting, if you're not wearing, like, a bag, is somehow inherently sexual. Because modesty actually doesn't become just about sex. It starts in the sexual realm, but it actually is a control mechanism that points back to imposing white women's body standards and Western worldviews body standards onto people and keeping that in place. And so I think sometimes I've seen the purity culture conversation miss that it's not just about control of women's bodies. It's about the upholding and uplifting of a particular beauty standard that then keeps white men in power in a particular way.
Mm. Yes, say that, please. Because when I was reflecting, thinking about this time, I was thinking about being a young woman in high school, right? And realizing, like, I grew up in a predominantly white area, right? And so I was one of the four or five Black kids all the way growing through school. And I, you know, I'm cute. I think I was cute. But I never dated anybody that was white. And of all my white crushes, none of those, that never ever happened. However, I could be that, you know, the counselor that helped them get, you know, in touch with their feelings enough so that they could talk to the girl that they had a crush on. So I was that person. Mm-hmm. So I think when, you know, that piece of like not seeing black women either over-sexualizing, but, or like, oh, but you're not like, we can't take you home to mom, right? This is, you are not in that space. This is where we don't play. And I think that being a black woman now and having black girls, right? Like noting how they're showing up with their bodies and how they're embracing their own bodies, which I have done a whole lot of work with them over. But I think they are already, like I can see, already sexualized by other by others. And I'm like, no, we don't do that. And helping them understand that. Helping them, like, they're kids. They're just, they're young. They're babies still. Yeah. And they still have to be, I have to explain to them that this is how you're being viewed. But this is who you are. Like, let's remember who you are.
Which is so hard to your previous note about college men. Mm. When everything becomes sexual, and then we combine, like, everything that anyone who's not a cis white man does is sexual. Like, black men are over-sexualized. Mm. Asian men are emasculated and, are considered unsexual or asexual. Like, there's all kinds of messages that we get. And all of those messages point toward this protection of this identity of a idealized white woman that somehow then gets like put in the Bible, and it's like, no, white women are Rachel and white women are Esther and white women are Ruth and like all these people who are not white women. Right. And so there's like all this horrible biblical work that you have to do, biblical, quote unquote, Bible. Mm-hmm. I'll say Bible interpretation. I won't even call it work because I don't think it takes any effort. But what the conclusion ends up being is that women are to make themselves small, modest, to perform humility, to perform some level of modesty. And then the thing that the church says it wants, which is like for people's hearts to be pure, never actually happens in any way or does any work, because you perform, it takes so much effort to perform this type of Christian cultural modesty that you don't actually even get to know why you're doing things or what you think about things, because you're so preoccupied. Or I'll say for myself, I was so preoccupied with what you described, which was not making people, not being responsible for the sin and hell of people around me, which I feel like is too heavy of a burden to bear. Mm. And so one of the definitions around modesty that's been helpful for me in evangelical space is behavior that presents a non-sexual image.
Ooh, say that again.
Because that has been, that's been helpful for me, is that behavior that presents a non-sexual image. Because if we can, if women can do that, then they become more desirable somehow. I don't understand. Again, the logic, when you start to break down the logic of modesty, it doesn't go anywhere. Right. And it's challenging because I'm going to be nerdy for a second here and describe modesty as a dependent virtue. Mm-hmm. That because, like, so I can say, I'm so modest. And you'd be like, well, no, you're not. Because by virtue of saying that you're modest, you're not. Mm-hmm. But if I'm modest about my wealth, it means I have wealth. If I'm modest about my beauty, it means I'm beautiful. If I'm modest about my intelligence, it means I'm intelligent. So modesty is a dependent virtue. It assumes the goodness of something already. And I think what ends up happening that I see is that Christians will take this dependent virtue of modesty, and then when they work backwards, they'll say like, oh, you're made in the image of God. But the image of God actually isn't the end point. It always is that idealized Western white women's version of what it means to be Christian, what it means to be a wife, what it means to be a partner. Mm-hmm. And it erases queer folks. And because that whole ideal is behaving in a behaving that presents a non-sexual way, there's never any kind of critique of how men's sexuality is playing out all over the church. Mm. And so there's a hyper-focus on men needing to deal with their hearts and then women needing to deal with their internal need to get attention. Because that's what I heard a lot from shitty white pastors was, ladies, like, we know you're not dressing how you want to dress just because, like, you want to dress that way. You're dressing that way because you want attention. Mm. And so I think there was all these, like, heart issue pieces that came out. And I think I'm losing the thread a little bit, but I think I'm just a little preoccupied by that idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think the idea that we are not capable of actually appreciating ourselves. or appreciating our bodies, or saying like, hey, I'm feeling ourselves, like feel like I feel good today in this. This is what I want to wear. That to me just negates it, like, oh, that's not reality. Everybody shows up someday that feels like I'm feeling good about this thing I did, this thing I like that's going on in my body, or how I feel about my workout, and what, or just how I feel, whatever it is, like regardless of gender, right? Like we all have something in us that we can point to at some point and say. So I think to say like, no, we can't, you know, when if you are dressing in a certain provocative, quote unquote, way, then you are looking for attention. That's, I feel like there's so much false there. So much false.
There is so much false there. Which we know, because statistically we know that this modesty culture and purity culture is not producing less sex among evangelical Christians. It straight up isn't. It's producing the appearance of less sex among evangelical Christians, but what it's really producing is a lack of honesty about what people are actually doing in their religious spaces.
Right, right. The secret keeping that it causes, right? Because if you are not showing up in your, or you could be showing up in your modest dress or whatever, but you can still be going, doing all, who knows what, right? And so I think there's all these, the reality of like you being able to own, you know, whenever you put a, like, don't touch those cookies, don't touch those cookies. Like, you're going to want to touch those cookies. Like, you're just putting a boundary that causes, instead of exploring, it causes like, oh, that red button that you're not supposed to touch, right?
Yes.
Well, and I think also the the word I want to use is evilizing, like the way that we look at women who dress in a, like showing their bodies, right, and putting that as like these are the others, right, setting them apart, mm-hmm. and it just adds more. It's just more of that, like who's in and who's out, right? Mm-hmm. It's drawing that line that it's so outside of what like even Jesus talks about in the Bible, so mm-hmm. other. And so I'm like, how are we deciding? How do we get to decide like what is modest? Who's mm-hmm. level? Who has the measure? Where is it coming yeah. from? And I think to be able to ask that question, I'm glad I can ask it now. But as a young person who is trying to learn and be obedient in church or in, you know, youth group, I'm just taking what these leaders gave me, and because that's how I knew how to do it, so I can yes. have grace for that younger Chrissy. But I feel like, oh, it makes me a little sick inside to know that like there's that examination isn't happening.
Yes,
in so many places that where young developing minds and bodies are.
Yes. And it feels important, too, because I think that many of us, I don't know, need to have that grace for ourselves that you're describing offering to yourself. Because most of us were threatened with the threat of hell or a bad marriage or being alone forever. Those were like the kind of main threats that are given to folks mm-hmm. who are presented with this idea of modesty. And the thing that it produces is hyperfixation rather than space for exploration. Right. And the fruit of purity culture has not been good. And so I think that there is an invitation for some folks to a space of exploration of self, of body, of others in such a way that allows us to not just hyperfixate, because I think that is so damaging to how we view God, because we assume that if we are hyperfixating, then God, how much more so is God hyperfixating mm-hmm. on our exploration? And I'm like, I just don't think it's like that. I don't understand the God of the scriptures to function like that. To care about things in that way, I don't see it. And so let's talk a little bit about scripture and how the Bible's used to justify this culture of modesty, because I think, I don't know, as you were talking about how women are told not to be or how we're taught not to be, that came straight from how people interpreted the Bible for me. And for me, it was like using Proverbs 7, which again, that was one of the scriptures that I know someone who wrote a song about, which is about like the prostitute who comes out into the streets and calls out and like is immodest and is whatever. And so I think a lack of modesty was always connected to sex work. Mm-hmm. And there was no Christian, no evangelical Christian interpretation of sex work as we're trying to have a more liberative experience, expression of, knowledge of. It was just like, prostitute is the ultimate. If there's a binary of like modest, good Christian girl, the binary opposite is a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And so it was essentially the message that I was getting from a lot of places was, don't be a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And then we would look at all of the stories of prostitution or sex work in the Bible and then be like, see, you don't want to be her. When most of the time those people are actually not being used as counterexamples, they're being used as examples of faith. So
yeah,
even that Bible work is bad. But I think I just remember that particular binary being set up to describe why someone shouldn't wear anything less than a cardigan.
Anything less than a cardigan. Right. Well, and I think that First Timothy passage was where I feel like I heard him over and over in Bible studies, like, oh, women must dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves with not elaborate hairstyles or gold or pearls or expensive clothes. And I think now I'm like, but that's talking about, like, don't go get your hair done. Like, don't put a whole lot of jewelry on. Like, don't show your wealth. That's where I look at it now. I'm like, oh, but somehow the decency and propriety part was like the part that got, that took over. And what decency and propriety looked like was the cardigan, right? Like, cardigan and knee-length skirts. So, yeah, I don't understand how we like did a whole lot of like spiritual gymnastics or to be able to put these things, to pull out what we've pulled out, and, you know, expand it into purity culture.
Absolutely. And I think that when I look at Peter and Paul, who both have similar ideas floating around in the Corinthians and the First Peters and the First Timothys, mm-hmm. so maybe Timothy, Peter, and Paul, mm-hmm. they all have a particular worldview about what is happening, and there's particular issues around money in Christianity, like mm-hmm. there's, or in the early Christians, and how they're related to empire. And I think that most of us who don't have any sense of church history are just like, well, just be modest, just do the thing, without looking at the economics of it, that create later separatist or monastic movements mm-hmm. that are deep critiques of how early Christians are in bed with the Roman Empire, in bed with an obsession with wealth and money, and thus, in the words of this text, adorning themselves in ways that create marginalization in communities of faith. Mm-hmm. And I think that God is actually deeply concerned about that. I see that all over the text. I see that all over. Yet we have things like preacher's sneakers with, where we make fun of men wearing $700 pairs of shoes, mm-hmm. but we don't do it in the same level of seriousness that we do critiquing how women are showing up in spaces. And I think how queer folks are showing up in spaces, because I don't know any other community that is as obsessed with the term flamboyant as Christians are. And that is a word that is associated with a lack of modesty. That is what that word is describing in most spaces. And so we frame queer folks as being inherently immodest and therefore hypersexual and therefore against God. And so I think the queer folks as the enemy of God in the gospel starts with this modesty ideology that we get in places like 1 Timothy, 1 Peter, and 1 and 2 Corinthians.
Mm. Wow. I hadn't heard it put that way. And to be honest, I hadn't had a dissection of that word flamboyant before, but I think, but as you're saying, I'm like, you're right. Like, that is really, yeah, that's troubling.
Yeah, I think it's why Christians throw like a little fit every year, or like conservative Christian spaces throw a fit every year at Pride, because it is the it feels to them as the antithesis of all of this modesty work that they've done to create pure Christian families. Mm-hmm. And what I hear in the description you say of the First Timothy passage too is that modesty becomes a temperance movement, I guess, like a temperance movement being moderation or voluntary self-restraint. Mm-hmm. And so evangelical Christian spaces position modesty as a voluntary thing that you do, but then put it under a Bible kind of whipping, as well as these authorities of power. And so modesty becomes a virtue that you choiceably engage in, which is not true in a world of coercion where when the threat of hell or exclusion from the community or sexual violence or being alone forever is at the center of it, modesty isn't a temperance movement. It's not a voluntary restraint or choice. Right. It's coercion. And right. so I think I have to understand modesty as an act of coercion as well.
Mm. Coercion and manipulation, right? Like, I think that when you're going to church or when you're going into these, you know, Christian spaces, you're there because you're wanting to follow God, usually. You're curious or you're decided or however you might be, however you show up. And so if someone up front or in a leadership position is telling you, like, this is what you have to do or else, then of course it's manipulation. It's a coercion of like, this is, but what I think though, is that the people from leadership don't understand it as that. They're not seeing that's mm-hmm. what they're doing.
No.
Because that's what they were taught to. And nobody's done, or not nobody, I shouldn't say, that's a broad stroke, but a lot of people have not done the work to figure out, like, well, wait, mm-hmm. is this okay? Like, why are we, tell me more about why, being curious about the scripture, tell me, and scripture versus the culture, right? Like, what, it, yes. being able to separate the two. And I think that is, there's just way more. I think we get lazy as Christians or people going just to church or going to, like, to not actually mm-hmm. do the work to pull apart, like, okay, this is how we're showing up, but why not? Like, even, I mean, small thing, my kids want to, you know, they're getting ready for church. They want to put on their sweats and their, and a cap. And internally I'm like, no, like, take off that. Put on something nice, you know, show up. But I hold it back because of why? Like, what's the point? They're clothes. Get them out the door. We're ready to go. But I've been told, I've been taught, this is the way, this is the culture. This is, you dress up, you mm-hmm. do this thing. And so fighting, and I get that it takes a lot of work to fight against what you've been taught, to dig, to pull it apart.
Totally.
And what is the reason? That's what I ask my teenagers. What is the point? Tell me what the point is.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to wear this, or what are you doing? Like, what is your point? You feel good in it? Fabulous point. But, or like, oh, you want to impress somebody with it? Is that a good point? Is that a good one? Let's find out. Like, so let's ask more questions. And so I think that being curious and pulling apart, like the realities that we live in, the water that we're swimming in, then mm-hmm. that feels, yeah, it feels like a lot of effort, but a necessary effort.
And I appreciate that question of why, because I think many of us have been forced into compulsive modesty or compulsive self-interpretations of how we dress. Because maybe if I'm going somewhere and I want to impress somebody, I'm like, okay, if that's my point and that's what I want to do, and that's what, there might be a time for that.
Sure.
But if I don't ask why and I'm compulsively engaging in what I'm doing, and I think it's different when you're raising kids, and I'm not a parent and I don't intend to be, so I'll keep my mouth shut on that stuff. But I do think that there are ways that as adults, they're asking that question of why is really, really helpful. Because mm-hmm. the message that many of us are given theologically is that you are not to draw attention to yourself, because if you draw attention to yourself, it deflects from Christ.
Mm.
And so it's the John, more of him, less of me. If you want to brand it cute, he is greater than I. It's 1 Corinthians, honor God with your body because your body is a temple. And it assumes this idea that modesty or honoring God with your body is covering as much of yourself as you can to deflect as much from yourself as you can. And I think, like, in the case of your kids, right, you're like, don't wear sweats or a cap. Like, oh, no, God, this is terrible. And it's because I think that compulsion in us comes because that draws attention too. And people interpret things all the time. And I think the judginess of Christians knows no bounds. And so many of us compulsively attempt to avoid the judginess of Christian spaces and what they think that means about us. And I think for many parents, about what it means about your parenting or how you're raising your kids or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that idea that we're honoring God with our body by being less ourselves is core to evangelical Christian ideas about what it means to be faithful or holy, and to be set apart is to be less yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think that so much of the relearning that we have to do is understanding theologically that I think that God is more interested in people being fully themselves,
mm-hmm.
And that is what honors God, is being fully oneself. It doesn't mean we don't have to do character work. It doesn't mean we don't have dysfunction. But it means that a constant deflection of oneself does not glorify God. Understanding ourselves as who God has made us to be is much more glorifying. And I think we see that in the text all over the place. So I do just think that that idea is really prevalent in how many of us think about or have internalized modesty as this holy thing, holy, like a holy thing, rather than as a mechanism of control that we've been talking about so far.
Yeah, like being modest equals don't take up space, right? Like that, I was reading through that definition, and that was what came to my mind, is like, we have been told not to take up space. And so something shifted in my own mind thinking about it, like, oh, like when I say take up space, it's good. Like, oh, I want to take up more space. I am actually coming with confidence, right? Coming with, what's the definition? Coming with pride and confidence in myself. Pride and confidence in who I've been created to be. Pride and confidence in who I'm growing into. As I am, like showing up in my body as I am, and taking up this space.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how convenient is that message of don't take up space? Because it doesn't apply to men in power, because the message for men in power is take up as much space as possible. Lead, be big and strong. Like, we assume masculinity in and of itself needs to take up space, that to be masculine is to take up space, to be assertive, to be bold. And so even the gender norms that we place on this that are unsustainable for almost everybody are a convenient tool that maintain the hierarchical power that is present in most evangelical churches. Which is exhausting. And I think that it's hard for me because there's so many New Testament messages ripped, like proof texted out of all of the letters that essentially say, like, the fruit of the spirit is self-control, therefore women and queer folks be self-controlled, but like, men, you are like fully unable to control yourselves, and therefore it's other people's responsibility. This is rape culture.
Yeah.
It's fully other people's responsibility to keep you from giving someone the wrong kind of attention. Because I think the message that I heard was, ladies, you don't want to attract the wrong kind of attention. And I just have to ask the question now, from who?
Right.
Like, who are you so worried about giving me the wrong kind of attention, rather than asking, who is giving me the quote-unquote wrong kind of attention? Which I think I have issues with that sentiment by itself, because anything sexual is considered wrong. And I'm like, oh, yeah, whatever. But I think the gender dynamics and the bifurcation of gender norms makes that even more violent. Well, can we talk a little bit about this idea of a stumbling block? Because I think that that was maybe the main text that was used, which was, you know, 1 Corinthians, I think it's in 1 Corinthians 8, it's like, don't be careful that you exercise your rights, but not become a stumbling block to the weak. And Paul is clearly talking about this relationship between Jewish folks and Gentile folks who are trying to figure out how to live Christianity together. And it's more talking about economics and food laws. Yeah. And Christians often pull that idea of being a stumbling block and then personify being a stumbling block as being a sexy woman, or as like a, I think the word adulteress comes up a lot because people pull that from New King James and NIV versions of the Bible. And they're like, well, everyone who is wearing a dress above their knees is like one step away from being an adulteress. So can you talk to me a little bit about how you heard that idea of a stumbling block being used? Because that was really prevalent in my background.
Well, it was the whole piece of what exactly what you're saying. Like, if you are dressed in a certain way, then this is how you come across. And I think that was, gosh, it just came with so much pressure, right? Like, if you aren't dressed properly, but then this is how you're going to be perceived. And so if you're a stumbling block, then it gives full permission for this man to then have his way or do whatever he's doing, because he has no responsibility of like his own actions. But I think when I remember particularly, so I had my babysitting money and I decided I was going to go and buy myself a two-piece swimsuit. And I went out with my friend who was not church going, and we went to the swimsuit store and I found this cute one or two piece suit, and I was sorry, swimsuit. You guys say swimsuit here. And I loved it. And I came home, brought it to my mom. She's like, oh, that's cute. I took it to my spiritual mom's house because we were going to go to the lake afterwards. And she was like, okay, well, I'm not your mother, but this, you know, you just know what kind of position you put yourself in when you are, you know, and mm-hmm. I was like, but it's cute. Like,
yeah,
look at that. It's fun. And it was literally the most modest, if you like, two piece that you could come across. But she like made me feel so much shame, right? Other women, mm-hmm. shaming other women to not yep. be a stumbling block, right? She was, and I listened to her and I didn't wear it that much because I felt like, oh, I don't want to put myself in that position. I don't want to be like seen that way, right? And so I felt like, okay, there's people who I can wear this with and there's other people who I cannot. So it divided mm-hmm. myself internally. And it also, I think that idea of being told that you will be a stumbling block, I mean, I can physically feel that those words said over me. Yes. I'm recalling the moment, right? Like, so I think there's both a such false truth that's being put on you, and then mm-hmm. the weight, the emotional weight and the emotional trauma or scarring that comes from being told that this is how you have, like, you have to show up in a certain way in order to be able to not, in order to not, like, cause other people to stumble, cause men to stumble. And that is, it doesn't make sense. And it feels very, just gross to me that is where that's where it falls, like, is on women versus on wealth mm-hmm. and money and the way that we look at our finances and the way that we think about giving. And I think that to me is like, oh, there's just so much wrong with that. There's so many pieces wrong.
Yes, and there's so much good we could do with that text. But what ends up happening is when Paul is talking broadly about, you know, don't be a stumbling block, he's not saying women don't be a stumbling block. He's saying, hey, community, don't become stumbling blocks. But even the imagery of, like, a man running toward God, and then you are an object that gets in the way of a good man running toward God. Like, that's the image for me that is so visceral in all of it. And the other thing I heard you describing in there is just that women become the policing agents for other women in how this modesty stuff plays out. So men don't actually have to. And I've seen this so many times where I've had a youth pastor come up to me and have me as a youth go talk to another woman in the youth group because he's mm-hmm. too uncomfortable to say the thing that he thinks needs to be said.
Right.
And so women and girls are taught from a young age to police each other through this language through how men call women sluts and whores and adulteresses and Jezebels. We'll call it adulteress and Jezebels and Eves in the text, because I was doing some research in conservative Christian space, which God help me every time I do it. But it was like, oh, the reason the fall happened is because Eve tempted Adam with her beauty. I was like, damn, y'all be out here interpreting.
Interpreting.
But there's a way that if you don't want other women around you to be an Eve or to be just out here doing whatever they're doing. So women become the primary enforcing and policing agents of modesty culture. And because modesty is also connected to self-control, it is assumed that the person who dresses more modestly, who sits in the dress code of Christian modesty culture, that person somehow has more control over their emotions. Or the one that I heard that makes me nuts, and I think is more true, I think this was true in a lot of Black spaces for me, is that it means that you respect yourself more, mm-hmm. that the more you cover yourself, the more you respect yourself, and therefore the more respect you deserve from other people. Because mm-hmm. if you don't respect yourself, then how can you expect other people to respect you? That one, I think, is really, really deeply embedded in mm-hmm. how I was taught about modesty culture and how I have experienced modesty culture taught across cultures.
Yeah. Yeah, that goes deep there. Because the idea of, what does it really look like to respect ourselves? Right? If we were actually respecting ourselves, does it mean that we would cover up? Or does it mean that we would be, you know, positing our ideas and our thoughts about life or whatever it is? Like, would we be taking up space when we respect ourselves? Like, it just... But I mean, it's troubling because it feels like, okay, this is, it causes so much damage internally, right? And the reality of being modest or being called a stumbling block or in this way, feeling like, okay, this is what with what you've just shared. I feel like it's just it shows up in every other area of your life, right? The damage that, that does. And it can show up in, like, not trusting your body, right? Like, not trusting in so many different areas, whether it's food or whether it's, like, your ability to do whatever it is, the imposter syndrome. Like, so much of that can stem from these lies that that we are being bathed in and taught and fed.
Absolutely. Well, I would love to hear, because I feel like we've talked a bit about how this impacts and shapes our experience of ourselves and of others. But can you talk a little bit about how you see this idea shaping how we interact with God? I know that we're Black women having this conversation, so I'm not going to speak to all of, like, the, I think we can broad stroke, maybe unhelpfully, but I think relatively accurately, that men aren't expected to be responsible for their own actions and then how they experience grace and mercy and salvation as concepts cover everything. So love always covers a multitude of sins for men, but it never covers a multitude of sins for the people who cause the sinning. And so I think there's some ways that we have to unlearn these ideas and how they teach us to relate to God, because for men, they will always remain in good standing because they have people like David as an example, who was like a total jackass and God loved him. And we say he's after God's own heart, which I'm like, oh, maybe he was after God's own heart at like one point in his life. And that probably shifted a little bit when he became a rapist murderer. But I think men take that example on and say, well, God always has grace and mercy for me, but I can still make other people the violent enemy. And so God becomes the same enforcer that men are in this culture. And so I'm wondering if there are any ways that you can think of that this impacts how we view God. How we view God and how this shapes our view of God and how God sees us.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very, my experience for myself and also with other folks has been thinking about God as this person who God looks at you with shame. Like if you are like someone to be ashamed of. And I think that having to relearn or unlearn like that is that goes deep. That's a lot of healing. That's a long-term healing situation there, because when we are seen as like adulterers because of the way that we're dressed, and that's happening externally, and then you have this picture of like, if I am not this way, then God will not accept me as I am. But you are still singing the songs that tell you and reading all the other scriptures. But then when it comes to this, it's like a no-go zone. And so I think about like the reality of some of the experience that it takes to actually come past that. I don't know if it's okay to move into that a little bit, but I spend a lot of time myself and with others trying to figure out, where is God in that feeling? Where is God in that conflict that you're having internally? Or where is God in that picture? Like, even as you can, if you go back to that moment where that pastor's wife was telling you something about your shirt or whatever, like where is God? And I think when we focus on our experience of God, and even visually in our mind's eye, able to kind of see where in this picture and work with it, because it doesn't always come show up the first time. You're not able always to totally. To know it right away. But I think giving yourself grace to walk into that and to try mm-hmm. to see, like, I think God shows up, and I've seen that every time, right? Like mm-hmm. like God does show up and is there waiting, and in whatever expression. And I think that trusting our experience is not what we are taught.
Mm-mm.
So like trusting and creating an experience with God, right? Like to like, okay, this is a whole lot of dookie that I've been served, Lord. Like, what, tell me, mm-hmm. let's sift through this. Like, what is it?
Yeah. Which is so important, because I think that many of us are taught that we're taught in word that the Bible is the only thing, or like God is the only thing that can be trusted, as though the Bible is God's mm-hmm. self. Mm-hmm. But really what we often mean is the interpretation of men's interpretation of the Bible is mm-hmm. the truth of God, which is a different thing entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what ends up happening is we use texts like Deuteronomy 4 or John 15, where God is, or Jesus are saying things like, if you love me, you'll obey my commandments, or like, I'll build a covenant with you if you obey me.
Mm-hmm.
And we make those into like, we turn, if you love me, so if I, Brandy, love God, I will obey God's commandments, to if I, Brandy, obey God's commandments, God will love me, which is not what the text says.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's an assumption of this earning of God's love, this maintaining of God's love, that is predicated on this type of modesty ideology. Mm-hmm. And I think that many of us just need to know that God doesn't see us as a liability.
Yeah.
That God doesn't see us as the one person who can destroy God's plans for men in the world, because really that's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't have to take the like words of Jesus where it's like, you know, if you lust after a woman, gouge your eyes out. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't make someone gouge their eyes out. You know, because I think that's what it comes down to, is
right.
There are going to be a bunch of people out here with no eyes
no
or
eyes.
Hands because of me. And I'm like,
yeah.
Like, damn, that's on y'all. Like, right. That is on y'all. And so I think for many of us who have been under the thumb of modesty culture and really what we'll just call dress codes and the kind of expansion of that dress code into values and morals.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us just have to know that God doesn't see us as a liability, that God is not fully dependent on us to protect people. I'm just like, how little do we think of the love of God? How little do we think of the investment of and commitment of God in our lives, if those are the conclusions that we're coming to through this weird dress coding. And so with all of that, I'm wondering if there's any advice you would give folks as they're unlearning
mm-hmm.
modesty culture. Because I think for me, honestly, it's just been like, well, I wear what I want to wear now. Mm-hmm. And I pay attention to how it feels.
Yeah.
Because I think that for me, even I'll wear something I feel really confident in, and then I go outside and I'm like, oh, what are other people thinking? What, mm-hmm. what do I do with that? And those are really great places for me to press in. And to ask questions and to engage and to ask, where am I being triggered by religious control mechanisms and religious trauma? And where am I just like looking out for myself? Where am I cold?
Mm-hmm.
Where am I not enjoying what I'm wearing because it's just uncomfortable and I like to be comfy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of those questions and like basic, simple things we can't get to when we're immediately triggered and kind of poured into a hole by the things that we've been taught in our religious spaces.
I love what you're saying there, Brandy, because like your own awareness of your own body, right? I think that was what we was taken away. And so mm-hmm. to come back to that, that would be like one of the first things I would say. It would be like coming back to your own awareness of body and awareness, your own needs. But also, I think kind of in large print, I would want to say, be gentle with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that just because it's really, it's really easy to feel like, well, I got to just change and do, you know, but there's a process and it's an unlearning. And I think the whole, like all of this, right? Like there's a lot mm-hmm. of unlearning, and there's so much you can learn from yourself. right? Yes. From, and so that noticing and slowing down and paying attention and being gentle, feels, those feel like just the pillars of unlearning. But also the giving it time. Like, give it the time that it needs, right? Like, you can't say, like, okay, now I've unlearned, you know, modesty and, like, with, by purity culture. And then, like, something comes up later on and you're like, oh, but I was done with that. No, like, it, give it the time. Mm-hmm. Give it the time that it's going to take.
Totally.
And I think, yeah, I think that's probably, that's what I would say. The advice I'd give.
I so appreciate that invitation because I think it gives people permission to be aware of themselves when modesty culture makes you consistently aware of others. So you're hyper aware of yourself in a moment when you're deciding what you're going to wear or do or how you're going to show up, but it's only because you're firstly hyper aware of others. So there's always a prioritization of the other above oneself. And I get the, like, see others as greater than yourself. You know, that's not what we're talking about. And so I feel like people are going to be like, boo, Jesus says things about seeing others as better than yourself and humility and all that. And I was like, yeah, but that, clearly in this conversation, that's not the point. And haters, whatever. It's just goofy. let's keep things in context of the conversation. Yeah. And, but I do think that there is an invitation to let yourself be aware of yourself and the only body you'll ever live in.
Right.
And I think that there's so much of our time that is spent not being or acting like we would want to, because we're so concerned about the implications that we've tied to hell and shame. That word shame that you use, which I just, we put out an episode with Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers on sexual shame. And I think these conversations are all in conversation with one another as we consider all of those realities. And so I think some of the invitation that you're describing is an invitation toward awareness and away from shame. And like we said earlier, away from hyperfixation into exploration. And what I love about exploration is that it gives you freedom to say, I liked that. I didn't like that. That felt good for me. That didn't feel good for me. I learned this about myself. Ooh, I suppressed this part of myself. And that all of that helps us to do the thing that I think is actually glorifying to God, which is us being fully ourselves and fully ourselves in God's world and figuring out what that means. So in that, I think some of the work that y'all are doing with soul reparations is so lovely and so good and so healing in all of this, because so much of spiritual direction for me, at least, has been learning to come back to myself and to who I am with God in those spaces. And so can you tell me a little bit about what Soul Reparations is up to? Give me a plug for what y'all are doing and how we can help at Reclaiming My Theology.
Yeah, absolutely. So Soul Reparations is a baby new organization. It's only a year old. Yeah, can you believe? And so we are now in our second year of fundraising. And this is the season that we are fundraising for the following year, for it starting in January. So last year we were able to serve 50 women, and which is phenomenal and amazing and mind-blowing to me that that happened. And so now in this next year we're hoping to be able to serve 100. There's already a waiting list, and so we would love, I'd love to plug just our fundraising efforts. You can find us at soulreparations.org. Also on Facebook and Instagram. So we have a goal this year of raising 120,000 to be able to serve those 100 women. And so you can check us out in those different platforms, write your name on the waiting list, or donate to help us to reach our goal.
Yes, thank you. And y'all, if there are other ways that you feel like you can serve that aren't just financial, like, we're looking for grant writers. We're looking for folks with design experience who want to volunteer. I don't know exactly what they're looking for, but I do know what it means to start a small business or a small nonprofit. And so if there's ways that you think you can serve too, please be in touch with me or with Soul Reparations, and we'll get you connected, because this work is so important. And at Reclaiming My Theology, as we often consider the ways that the most marginalized people in our communities are experiencing things, this kind of work for women of color is key and core to our I want to say mission. It's weird because I'm like, kind of post that worldview in Christian space, but mission is still a word that exists in other places.
True.
But that is a part of our mission, is to help correct the wrongs of evangelical Christian violence, knowing that white men will never save us. And so we have to do the work ourselves. And so if you are a part of this work and want to be a part of the practical application of that work, Soul Reparations is a great place to start. And so with all of that, Chrissy, I just want to say thank you for being on. It's been so helpful and so lovely. And I think a lot of people will experience just really humanizing, because I think at the end of the day, modesty culture and these dress codes and their implications dehumanize and objectify and create cultures of objectification. And I think you've given us some pathways away from thinking of those things in such a way.
Thank you, Brandi. I really appreciate this time.
Anytime, truly. Thank you for joining for another episode of Reclaiming My Theology. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, review, or tell your friends to help others find the podcast. You can also join us on Patreon at patreon.com/reclaimingmytheology, but honestly, you're already helping out just by listening. We are really excited to announce some things in the next few weeks about what's going to be coming from Reclaiming My Theology, especially to you Patreon folks. Y'all are great. Y'all have been so patient and kind with me, and there's some new ways that we are going to be engaging in the coming months, and so I'm so grateful for y'all and want to reiterate that as I continue to do what I call us to do every week and will again now, to try to do a little bit better together. See y'all next week. No, see you in 2 weeks. Bye weekly.